Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 11th episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. This is the first of a three-episode arc where we'll focus on the Roman Empire as a space where people, things, and ideas moved freely. In the first piece of this, we'll talk about the Roman economy as it had come to exist in the 3rd and 4th centuries. In the second, we'll talk about how the Roman economy fell apart in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, and what replaced it. In the third episode, we'll discuss mobility and communications, my actual specialty and the subject of my dissertation. What all of these topics have in common is an emphasis on movement, of people, of things, and ideas. The same roads, the same shipping routes, the same ports, the same ships that carried grain and wine also carried travelers, pilgrims, soldiers, books, and religious concepts. When one pattern changed, so did the others. That's why we're going to treat them all together, in dialogue. We can talk all we want about the political structures of the Roman Empire, about the barbarians, about the army, whatever. But we can't truly understand what made the Roman world Roman until we understand what and how it tied its various places and regions into a coherent whole. That's why the economy matters. So let's talk about the Roman economy. Basically, there are two different approaches to talking about the Roman economy that emphasize different things. I'll outline them for you in broad, kind of crude terms. The primitivist position, also called the substantivist position, emphasizes the ways in which the ancient economy was unlike the modern economy, pointing to things like how the elite's concern for status drove them toward rent-seeking behavior and emphasized land ownership rather than commercial enterprise. The modernist, or formalist, approach highlights similarities between the ancient and modern economies, focusing on commercial enterprise, trade, price-setting markets, and, to some degree, what we would consider basic economic rationalism. If you've listened to any of the episodes of this show that have touched on the economy, especially the deep dives we took into the provinces of North Africa, Britain, and Gaul, or the episode on the army, you can probably guess as to which side of this debate I prefer. I'm much more on the modernist side of the equation, because I think it better captures what was distinctively Roman about the Roman economy. But it's important for you to know that the other side of this debate exists, and it makes some good points about the nature of the Roman economy that we need to bear in mind as we move forward. In any case, this isn't so much a binary choice as it is a kind of a spectrum of analyses. We can pick and choose different arguments about different things that we find more convincing, and in my case, the sum total of those choices places me closer to the modernist side than the primitivist. So what was distinctively Roman about the Roman economy? This is going to be the fundamental topic of today's episode. What we mean when we talk about the economy, how we know what we do about the economy, and how it changed from the time of the Republic to the late Empire. In the next episode, we'll talk more in depth about the collapse of the Roman economy and the rise of what replaced it. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. So what was the Roman economy? Well, it was fundamentally agrarian. It shares that in common with practically every pre-modern economy. Maybe there are some counterexamples, but if so, I'm not aware of them. So when we say the Roman economy was a fundamentally agrarian one, we mean that it was based on agriculture, organic fuels, and home production of goods. This was the foundation of the pyramid from which everything else flowed. There was more to it than that, though. The economy also built on a network of cities, monetization, market exchange, taxation, and last but certainly not least, chattel slavery. Not every pre-modern economy includes all or even any of these things. In the Roman case, they had existed in part in different places in the Eastern Mediterranean. Part of what made the Roman economy Roman was that they were exported to the Western Mediterranean, where they hadn't existed in that form or scale before. The other fundamentally Roman thing about the Roman economy, something that can't be overstated, is that this was the first and only time the entire Mediterranean was united under the rule of a single political unit. Now, we have to understand the Mediterranean as a connective force for the places and regions that surrounded it. It was a superhighway that enabled mobility, communication, and of course, trade. In a broad sense, it allowed for what we can label connectivity between places and regions. Those patterns of connectivity weren't set in stone. They weren't the natural consequence of geography or ecology. Ecological, economic, social, and political factors could all shape those patterns in important ways. Carthage was closely tied to Sardinia, for example, for most of its history as a city. It's where they grew a lot of the food that fed the city. That 500-year connection, though, fell apart when Carthage was sacked and destroyed, and Sardinia's place within broader Mediterranean patterns of connectivity changed dramatically. The Roman Empire, its political structures, the needs of the state, its emphasis on infrastructure, and so on, enabled particular kinds of large-scale connectivity in the Mediterranean and beyond in ways that were never seen before or after. It brought together the mineral-rich Spanish interior and the swampy Italian coast, tied estates in North Africa, where olive oil and pottery were produced, to markets in Britain and northern Gaul. It allowed wine from Palestine to fill cups in Sicily and Greece, and soldiers born beyond the Rhine to serve the emperor in the Syrian desert. The Roman Empire was the force that drove this connectivity and the movement it enabled. There's one more thing we need to talk about before we move on to the meat of the episode. The peak of the Roman Empire in the first 2 centuries CE coincided with a nice climatic optimum, a warm period that allowed more and more varied kinds of land to be brought under cultivation across the empire. This expanded, in a Malthusian sense, the limits of the potential population that the land of the Roman Empire could support. When the climate got colder again, starting in the 3rd century CE and reaching its downward peak in the 6th or 7th century, those limits shifted downward again. Now, this isn't to say that people were slaves to climatic fluctuations, or that these shifts affected everywhere in the Roman world equally. That's called environmental determinism, and it's a poor approach that removes human agency completely. But in a basic sense, ecological constraints did set the outer boundaries for what was possible. So how did the Romans think about the economy? Did they have a theoretical framework for understanding it, a kind of an ancient equivalent of Adam Smith? The answer to that is no. The old stereotype is that the Romans were doers, more concerned with practical applications than theory, and at least in this case, it kind of holds true. There were no Roman handbooks of economic thought or guides to trade, at least none that have survived, although they did think about agriculture and household management in pretty sophisticated ways. If we study what the Romans actually did, though, it becomes clear that they did think and act in sophisticated ways that firmly placed them in the rational empiricist camp. More than anything, the Romans kept copious records. Provincial governors regularly produced reports. They regularly conducted censuses, one of the defining characteristics of the Roman world. They kept archives of direct and indirect taxation and customs records. The army, as we discussed in the last episode, was a bureaucratic institution that could only function because it kept detailed records of payroll and supply. Even outside the official domain, we know that at least some estates kept financial records, and that they used those records to plan for the future and maximize profits. Accounting was a highly developed art, though it would be lost and not rediscovered again until later in the Middle Ages. Now, if you're going to maximize efficiency and profitability, it's the definition of rationalism, you need information on which to draw. You need data. We know the Romans kept it. Now, we need to bear all this in mind when we talk about the Roman economy as a fundamentally agrarian one. Agrarian economies can be unsophisticated and straightforward, with a focus on individual subsistence farming, but the Roman economy wasn't one of those. Even if there were a substantial number of what amounted to subsistence farmers, the broader effects of that rational organization and the market economy bled into even these small farmers' daily lives. As the historian Gloria Vivenza summed it up, Roman farming was, quote, a profitable, well-developed activity integrated with other economic sectors. The raw productivity of the agricultural sector is what allowed for everything else, for cities, for manufacturing, for mining, for trade. The economic historian Jeffrey Krohn offers this overview, which I think captures the whole dynamic pretty well. Quote, "Our sources and archaeological evidence present a coherent picture of market-oriented, intensive mixed farming, viticulture, wine production, arboriculture, tree raising, and market gardening, comparable and often superior in its productivity and agronomic expertise to the best agricultural practices of England, the Low Countries, France, and Northern Italy in the mid-19th century." This was a complex series of practices. Roman farmers selected seeds, hoed to destroy weeds, tilled effectively, rotated crops, rotated in legumes to restore the soil, irrigated, had knowledge of managing manure, carefully managed grazing land for livestock, and selectively bred their cattle, which were substantially larger during the Roman period than they had been before or would be afterward. This piece about livestock is important because large numbers of well-managed and well-cared-for livestock produced the huge amounts of manure necessary to carry out really intensive farming. The evidence for all this livestock is everywhere on Roman period archaeological sites. Now, this rosy picture applies mostly to the Mediterranean-adjacent heartland of the Roman Empire, and more marginal regions, like the remote parts of Britain or the Balkans, might have been operating at something closer to a subsistence level. They wouldn't have been as well integrated into the broader market economy. There was a fair bit of diversity in how land was used, both between and within regions. These patterns also varied over the imperial centuries, with different modes of agrarian exploitation being practiced in the same place at different times. There were farmers who owned their own land, some of whom were exceptionally poor and relied entirely on their own labor. Others were well off and owned slaves or hired free workers to supplement their own labor. There were tenants who leased plots from a landlord, ranging from the poorest sharecroppers to relatively well-off lessees, again who might have had their own slaves to help them out. And finally, there were estates that employed a freely hired or an enslaved workforce, or some mixture of the two. Now, we could spend an entire episode talking about small farmers. That's a big topic, and it's an important one, especially in the context of social history. They were a meaningful part of the economy, who were just as tied into the markets for agricultural goods as the large estates were. In one survey of rural Etruria, just north of Rome, some 43% of all buildings found were classified as small farms, compared to just 22% being classified as villas. In the Liri Valley, about 60 miles southeast of Rome, small farms remained the norm from the 4th century BC until the 6th century CE. Now, in North Africa, around the city of Caesarea to the west of Algiers, villages composed of small farmers who owned their own land existed alongside large estates. So you can see, even within a small geographic area, you could have major differences in organization and different settlement types existing alongside each other at the same time. We could do the same kind of thing for any region in the Roman West, and archaeological surveys have. With that said, though, it was the big estates that were the most characteristically Roman thing about the economy. They were the baseline form of organization that enabled, structured, and reinforced everything else, especially the market-oriented nature of the economy.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cashback. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal, or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
These big estates, villas, dominated the agricultural and therefore economic life in the western provinces of the empire. And all of those technical advances that we mentioned earlier, like seed selection, livestock management, and what have you, were more likely to be practiced there than on small farms. We also know the most about these estates, not least because their aristocratic owners were the ones who wrote the sources that survived, and the remains of their big houses, these villae, are much easier to spot and excavate archaeologically. These villas became progressively more important, more central to the economy over the Roman centuries. In archaeological surveys of the countryside, it's common to see more and more villas pop up in the first couple of centuries AD, while small farms were abandoned. The countryside didn't get less prosperous in material terms, though, and the population didn't decline. It just grew more and more concentrated around the large landholdings of the elite. In technical terms, settlement patterns became more nucleated. This was the case for Sicily, for example, and in the rural hinterland around the city of Tarragona in Spain. Now, estates varied a great deal from place to place and time to time, though. The villa houses could be huge and palatial, covering tens of thousands of square feet with all the amenities a super-rich aristocrat could desire, including ornate mosaic floors, wall paintings, marble columns, and even private bath complexes. They could also be rustic and plain, little more than whitewashed walls and timber beams under a tile roof. No matter what they looked like, though, practically all of them were working farms, the center of settlement around which a whole bunch of land and a whole bunch of different economic activities revolved. The land concentrated around a single villa might support a wide variety of agricultural practices. There could be wheat or barley, olive groves, grapevines for wine, fig trees, lentils, you name it, depending on the particular climate of the area that we're talking about, the preferences of the owner, and of course the broader context of the markets to which the villa was connected. Villas were also centers of food processing distribution, though. They're where olives and grapes went to be pressed and stored in amphorae, where the grain came to be bagged up for transport, or alternatively, ground and maybe also baked into bread. Villas were also an essential part of how the Roman Empire's elite thought about the economy, their role within it, and more broadly about power and status. From the beginning of the Republic to the end of the Empire, Roman elites thought of themselves fundamentally as landholders. That was the basis from which their wealth derived, and it's what they thought made them important. Ideologically speaking, they disdained commercial activity, merchants, money grubbing, manufacturing, anybody who had to do actual work for a living, and especially any jumped up, nouveau riche interloper who had made his money in these kinds of dishonorable activities. The famous character Trimalchio, in Petronius's Satyricon, is the best example of elite prejudices toward these activities. Pliny the Elder, for example, famously stated in his Natural History that all wealth, period, derived from land. There were varying opinions about what kind of estate was best, though. Pliny the Elder spoke out against latifundia, the big slave-operated, plantation-style estates, and his nephew Pliny the Younger advocated owning a number of smaller estates located in diverse regions and ecological environments. Rome's wealthy aristocrats might own dozens of estates scattered across multiple provinces. So let's dig into an estate and think about how it functioned. Our best evidence for estate management comes from Egypt, where the kinds of everyday documents like tax records, records of harvest yields, employment records, and things like that are most likely to survive because of the dry, hot environment. Now, Egypt is a bit of an outlier, since the Nile's annual flooding allowed for incredible productivity and density of population and wealth, but it's unlikely that estate management practices used there were totally unknown elsewhere in the empire. Where we have the same kinds of evidence in other provinces, it generally agrees with the broad outlines of what we find from Egypt. So what does that evidence tell us? Well, to follow the argument of a historian named Dominic Rathbone, whom I find very convincing, the evidence speaks to what we might call an economically rational approach to running an estate. In Rathbone's view, founded on one particularly rich store of documents from the Appianus estate in 3rd century Egypt, this estate had a centralized management and secretariat, it had a centralized transport system, and it had diligent managers who thought long and hard about how to maximize the estate's profitability. This meant that they focused on crop specialization in the parts of the estate most suited to them, so wine here, grain there, and what have you, and how to move labor and equipment from place to place. They had a system of credit across the entire estate and kept accounts of all exchanges in monetary terms, which allowed them to evaluate production costs and productivity. Ultimately, this allowed managers to make decisions about how much of which crop to produce for sale in which commercial market. The gathering of information about the business, which is what the documents from the Appianus estate show us, is the baseline necessity on which making economically rational decisions is predicated. This is, in a nutshell, very much the way a modern manager trying to run a business would evaluate her holdings, according to productivity and profitability, on the basis of as much information as possible. Now, in fairness, the Appianus estate is a bit of an outlier. It was huge, wealthy, and as I said, it was located in the wealthiest part of the wealthiest province of the Roman Empire. The documents all date from just before Diocletian's massive reorganization of the tax system of the empire and the serious monetary problems that went along with this phase. It's entirely possible that the documents Rathbone used to draw his convincing conclusions represented something like the high point of what we're calling economic rationalism, and that there was a serious decline afterward, even in wealthy Egypt. This is plausible, and in fact, there's a really good book called Wine, Wealth, and the State by a fine scholar named Todd Hickey that looks at documents from another Egyptian estate in the 5th and 6th centuries, so a couple of centuries after Rathbone's. In that book, Hickey makes a pretty good argument for a more primitive economic outlook, something much more basic and less developed than the rationalism of the Appianus estate a few centuries earlier. Basically, to simplify a complex and interesting argument, the owners of this estate preferred a less risky but less profitable management strategy focused more on subsistence, with only small surpluses of cash crops being produced for the market, and even then in kind of haphazard, disorganized ways. So how do we reconcile these views? Well, it's possible that the later estate Hickey looked at was more representative of a downward trend that led from the high point of the Appianus estate to a more basic form of management and production that was less focused on profitability and markets and more on maintaining local control. It's also possible that wine from this estate was, for one of several reasons, less competitive on the commercial market and therefore not worth trying to use as a cash crop. It's also possible that more and better surviving documentation from this estate would reveal something more like the earlier situation. We always have to bear in mind that our sources aren't giving us a complete picture. With documents like this, survival is entirely accidental. The papyrus documents that gave us all this information about these two estates, for example, were found in a literal trash heap. I'm not joking, they were literally garbage, and we happened to find them. We don't have anything like this wealth of documents for estates in the Western Mediterranean, but I'd say they were probably run with these economically rational principles in mind. They weren't as big and weren't as wealthy as the estate of Appianus that Rathbone looked at, but there's no reason to think that they couldn't have kept detailed records of accounts, to have thought about labor in monetary terms, and to have weighed productivity and profitability. We may not know about their internal organization, but we know what they produced and whom they sold it to, and there's no doubt that estates in the Western Mediterranean were organized around producing agricultural and other goods for commercial markets. So, as we discussed, the Roman economy was a fundamentally agrarian one, but it was also a market economy. To paraphrase the economic historian Peter Temin, whose work and insights I follow closely, markets knit the individual pieces of the Roman world together closely enough that we can call it a market economy, and that the empire allowed for regional specialization and therefore massive overall benefits from comparative advantage. Now, comparative advantage is one of the oldest and best attested concepts in economics. Let's say you and I eat bread and we drink wine. We can both grow the wheat, grind the grain, bake the bread, grow the grapes, press them, and make the wine. That way we both get the wine and the bread. But maybe my land's better for wheat and yours is better for vines. If I focus on grain and you focus on wine and then we trade, we can both produce more than either of us alone would have focusing on both things. That's comparative advantage in a nutshell, and it's why, on a basic level, trade works as an organizing economic concept. Now apply that basic concept of comparative advantage to the entire Roman Empire, a conglomeration of different places with varied ecological potential to grow and make many different things. Apply that concept in the context of a political system that encouraged integration and communication between regions while providing the infrastructure that allowed goods and people to move freely from city to city and region to region. The existence of the Roman Empire lowered transaction costs, things like shipping rates, tariffs, and what have you. This is what enabled the large-scale movement of the bulk goods that the Roman economy excelled at producing, like wheat, wine, olive oil, fish sauce, and pottery, from one economically specialized region to another. There were other things that contributed to the functioning of this economy. We haven't talked much about it, but money was absolutely essential. I don't just mean that it was more convenient to use coins than having to barter goods for goods in a barter system, though obviously that's not a bad thing. Having money and having a monetary economy are two different things. A monetary economy isn't just the presence of coinage. It's also a mode of thinking that can conceptualize goods, services, and labor in abstract, monetary terms, and that flexible approach enables a whole lot of other things. For example, it's the basis of the kind of economic rationalism that I mentioned at the Appianus estate in Egypt. The managers there were thinking about labor and other production costs in monetary units, and they were thinking about productivity and profitability in monetary units. This monetary economy allowed for financial specialists and some basic financial instruments, too. There were professional bankers in the Roman world called argentarii, or after the 2nd century CE, numularii, and they became quite sophisticated. They accepted deposits of money, and they provided interest to depositors. They changed money, either from foreign currency or between Roman denominations. Most important, they provided loans. The Romans didn't have a concept of productive loans in the way that we do, you know, kind of a loan as an investment in commercial activity of some kind, but nevertheless, those productive loans did exist. We have references to loans being used to repair a ship, pay sailors, buy merchandise for future sale, or purchase land and slaves, all of them with expected repayment periods of less than a year. Now, these bankers were essential to the functioning of commercial markets, especially the smaller-scale agricultural ones frequented by small farmers in the countryside. A grammatical note on a work of the poet Horace intended to explain the meaning of the word argentarius gives us an example of how this worked. A traveling trader buys olives from a wholesaler, and the banker, the argentarius, pays the seller. A coactor, a money receiver, then reimburses the banker on behalf of the buyers once they've sold the olives. These short-term loans were the province of professional bankers, the argentarii or numularii I mentioned, who may have been quite rich, but nevertheless weren't among the elite. It's impossible to overstate just how important these kinds of relatively small-scale transactions are to the functioning of a commercial, market-based system, and how much they contributed to the monetization that had so thoroughly gripped the Roman economy. These bankers weren't the only ones who advanced loans, though, and this brings us back to the great estates and the elites who owned them. I mentioned earlier the elites' prejudices against commercial activity and the kind of money-grubbing it entailed, which they considered to be beneath their exalted status. That didn't stop them from putting their landed wealth to use in commercial ventures, though. It was members of the elite who provided the larger and longer term loans or other financing approaches that helped drive the biggest businesses. It was mostly elite capital that financed maritime loans, for example, generally through trusted slaves who ran money lending operations. Their money could be put to use for productive purposes throughout the broader economy. The elites also put their money to work on their own estates and holdings. When they had money to spend, they might invest in multiple olive oil or wine presses, serving as a center for production of those commodities, even if they weren't growing the olives or the grapes themselves. This pattern was especially marked in southern Gaul and Iberia in the first 2 centuries AD, where archaeologists have found an explosion of villa sites with more than one press. The only explanation for this is production for a larger market, rather than self-sufficiency for their estates. Pottery production of the kind we've discussed at great length in earlier episodes often took place on estates too. It makes sense, right? If you're making the wine and the olive oil there, you might as well make the containers to transport it in too. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on them, but there were, of course, other segments to the Roman economy. Mining was a huge deal, especially in Iberia, where industrial-scale silver mines employed as many as 40,000 slaves on a single site and left traces of their pollution in Greenland ice cores. Manufacturing was an essential segment of the economy, though it didn't take the form of the kind of vertically integrated factory operations that we're familiar with. Instead, they preferred more of a decentralized network of workshops that may have specialized in particular things, but which operated according to trust and long-term relationships. In the textile industry, for example, there were specialized dyers, fullers, and what have you, but much of the thread would have been spun by women working from home. That's decentralization. Now, underpinning all of this economic activity was a framework of legal thought. The Romans were big on contracts and their enforcement, and we have a wealth of legal texts that speak to these issues. You can't have a market economy without firm ideas about property and transactions, not just written law, but also norms, and Roman morality made the fulfillment of contracts something like a matter of personal honor. Now, I don't want to get too deep into this, but it's important to note that this framework existed. In the final segment, we'll take a stab at summarizing this economy and figuring out how it changed in the late empire.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
So let's take stock of what we have here. We have a fundamentally agrarian economy focused around large estates owned by a powerful, wealthy aristocracy that became increasingly more so over the first 2 centuries CE during the Pax Romana. There were also mining and manufacturing sectors of the economy. In all cases, we can firmly say that production was geared toward commercial markets, which set prices and operated according to principles of supply and demand. The Roman state provided the infrastructure and the baseline that allowed for these markets to exist on a trans-Mediterranean basis. It built and maintained the incredibly dense network of roads and ports that allowed all those goods to move from fields to estate centers, to ports, to ships, to ports, to markets, something we'll talk a lot more about in a future episode. Now, this is not to say that the Roman economy was full of little proto-capitalist homines economici running around according to the perfect market-based models of modern economics trying to maximize their profitability, but markets are essential to understanding how it functioned. What I've presented is essentially the picture of the Roman economy at the end of the 2nd century CE, a little earlier than most of what we've talked about in this show. Then came the crisis of the 3rd century. This was a crisis in several parts, something we've talked about a few times. It was a crisis of the bonds of loyalty that bound the army to the emperor. It was a crisis of frontier defense. It was an ongoing series of personal failures by a series of emperors that created political crisis after political crisis. And last but not least, it was a serious economic and demographic crisis. The Roman Empire of the first 2 centuries CE was a marvel by practically any metric, from political stability to population size to urbanization, and underpinning all of that was its economy. That all came grinding to a halt in the 3rd century, but more so in some places than others. There was a monetary crisis due to rampant currency debasement, there was plague, which drastically lessened demand for goods and services and the size of the available workforce while cratering the price of land. There were constant wars and predation along the frontiers. There were breakaway provinces that cut into tax revenue. Now, there's real debate as to how much of a crisis this actually was, and some regions, like I said, came out of it just fine. Others, however, did not. In the countryside around Tarragona in Spain, for example, 58% of the 2nd century settlements were abandoned in the 3rd century. There was a serious downturn in wine and oil production in southern Gaul over the course of the 3rd century, too. All across the Mediterranean, exchange and trade dropped off in a huge way, falling to levels not seen since the 3rd or 2nd centuries BCE. But following the reforms of Diocletian and his immediate predecessors, something much different emerged. The monetary system changed. A new aristocracy of bureaucratic office holders emerged. New patterns of trade came to be, and some regions, like I said, came out of the crisis smelling like roses. Now here, I want to note that I'm following the work of a tremendously sharp scholar named Gyrus Banaji. This might be a little controversial in academic circles, so if you want to argue about it, get at me, but I don't think the full implications of Banaji's basic point have been fully appreciated. This is it. In the late empire, quote, gold came to circulate at a floating rate, end quote. Now that sounds pretty basic, right? In fact, this means that the entire monetary system of the empire changed in the late 3rd and early 4th century. There was no attempt to tie the value of the new gold coinage to the silver and bronze that also circulated at the same time. The long-run effects of this are enormous. It allowed for further and deeper monetization of the Roman economy, which stimulated trade. This is exactly what we see in the 4th century, a drastic uptick in exchange across the entire Mediterranean in both volume and value. The empire of the 1st and 2nd centuries CE might have had a larger population and a larger economy, but the late empire was far more integrated within and between regions. This is a key insight. If you'll recall something I said in the episode on Britain, I think it was episode 6, quoting the historian Robin Fleming, late Roman Britain was much more thoroughly, well, Roman than it ever had been before. That holds true not just for Britain, but for practically everywhere in the West. Now, the key knock-on effect of this shift to gold was the increased economic power of the aristocracy, along with a serious shift in the composition of the aristocracy. Now, remember, there was a massive expansion of the bureaucracy over the course of the 3rd century, culminating under Diocletian at the end of the 3rd century. This new service aristocracy and the members of the old order who came through the crisis had privileged access to this new gold coinage, the coinage that had the greatest value on the market. The basis of wealth shifted from land to money, and land was valuable insofar as it generated money. In essence, the aristocracy was the group that was poised to take advantage of this shift in the monetary economy, this enormous change. That's exactly what we see. That's why I like this thesis, is because it best explains what we actually see in the evidence, the huge overarching patterns. Now, in the episode on North Africa, episode 8, I talked a lot about the massive agricultural expansion there in the late 3rd and early 4th century, especially in the production of olive oil. Huge new areas came under cultivation, thousands of new oil presses were built, and hundreds of kilns were constructed to produce the amphorae in which the oil would move to markets. The sheer scale of all this activity is just mind-boggling. One solid estimate of annual production of olive oil, just one crop, for just the province of Tripolitania, which is just one North African province, and even then just for export to Rome, which is just one market, is 1 million liters per year. A million liters per year. The only group with the available capital in the form of that new gold coinage that could have financed this enormous expansion was the aristocracy. They had the resources to reshape their holdings, to produce for the export market, and to convince the state to pay for the transport infrastructure to get it to market. That last piece is essential here. The aristocracy, this new aristocracy, was involved in large-scale public business, in the business of the state. They were working as officials within the civil and military bureaucracy, and it's not hard to see how they might have directed public resources to their benefit. That road over there that's getting repaired? Well, it just happens to be the one that the governor's family estate uses to get its wine to market. That port that's being expanded with tax funds? Well, that's the one the local aristocracy uses to export its grain. That contract to supply the army with horses and draft animals? Well, it's going to a local aristocrat who happens to own a breeding operation, and his brother is the local army commander. That's not to say that the non-elite didn't benefit from these things. There were definitely folks who ran transport businesses, there were bankers, sailors, and other middlemen who absolutely did. But it was the elite who got the most out of this new economy. All across the Roman Empire, the rich got richer as they poured their wealth into new commercial ventures. There was a massive wave of investment in palatial rural villas, something which is best documented in Spain, but it's also visible elsewhere, notably in Britain. It seems that the largest landowners bought up their smaller neighbors and created estates of ever-increasing size and commercial complexity, consolidating more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands. The aristocratic families of the late Roman West were an order of magnitude wealthier than their predecessors at the top of the social scale. Viewed in this light, we can see why. They were effectively the equivalent of diversified multinational corporations with a wide range of business interests and multiple holdings, along with the capital to invest even further. This is why Banaji's point about gold is important. It explains all of this, down to the third and fourth order effects. This was one substantial difference between the Western and the Eastern parts of the Roman Empire. The aristocracies of the West were, relatively speaking, drastically richer and more powerful, while in the East, cities, so urban elites, and small farmers were relatively more important. There was also more money in circulation in general in the East, which meant that the aristocracy didn't have quite as much inherent sway. Merchants were more plentiful and better organized in the East. Ironically, one of the late empire's great bequests to the Middle Ages in the West would be these huge, centrally owned estates, even after the context that created them had long since passed. Now, I want to close with a few remarks on the role of the state in all this. I'll get into it a little more in the next episode when we talk about how this economy of the late empire fell apart, but we need to get it out there now. So, it's not just that the state built and maintained the infrastructure that lowered transaction costs to the point where others could profitably move bulk goods, like agricultural products, from one place to another over long distances. The state itself also had tremendous needs for supplies, especially the annona, that supplied the cities of Rome and Constantinople with grain, and Rome, in addition, with oil. To service these needs, the state not only maintained transport infrastructure, it also subsidized the construction, maintenance, and running of the ships necessary to bring those goods to market. In essence, it created a baseline level of the production and movement of goods and infrastructure that private enterprise could then build on. So, this is more or less the Roman economy as it existed in the middle of the 4th century, or at least it's my picture of it. It's important to note that we could have told a very different story, one of the importance of production for local needs, subsistence, of the dictates of subsistence in a Malthusian sense, of the central role of small farmers, or we could have told a story focused on the relationship between labor and ownership and how it shifted over the centuries, because it did shift in really big, meaningful ways. There's nothing at all wrong with those stories, and I wish that I had time to tell them all. But I think that what stands out the most about the Roman economy is how advanced and complex it was, that it was in meaningful ways a market economy, that it was fully and thoroughly monetized, and that at least some people, in some places, at some times, acted in ways that we would consider economically rational. There was trade in huge quantities between regions separated by long distances. This was a world where you could drink Gaulish wine in Sicily, spend coins minted from Spanish silver along the Rhine frontier, and eat off of North African ceramics in a villa in Britain. You could buy a cloak made from Italian wool in the Spanish Meseta, or eat bread baked from Egyptian grain in Constantinople. If you were a soldier in a Danube fort, your wine probably came from the sunny climes of the Aegean. That, to me, is the story that stands out about the Roman economy, one of movement on a massive scale. Next time, we'll talk about how that economy fell apart and try to put ourselves in the shoes of a few people as they navigated the end of the Roman economic world. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. Or if you want to help me out even a bit more, you can take the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's WONDERY.com/survey. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line anytime. If you're looking for more history podcasts, check out History Matters on iTunes and SoundCloud. A historian friend of mine and I, Keith Plimers, are talking about present-day issues and historical perspective, tackling topics like the idea of progress, political breakdown, the economy, settlement patterns, migration, and much, much more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.